Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and either a drum roll or a rim shot, depending upon your point of view. Welcome, everybody, to our second anniversary show as we lean into our third year. When we did the post show last time we were live, Eagle One and I kind of had a little giggle at our own expense going, we've really been doing this for 2 years. We keep having more people come in and listen. So for the regulars that are here, either live or are getting to us via the archive or iTunes, you're the reason that we're going into a third, because we had decreased listenership. Somebody would take up golf and we would go do something else. So we really appreciate the vote that y'all given us and a lot of the feedback that we've gotten as well. We've had some of y'all send us email with guest recommendations that have just turned out great. I think those that have listened to our shows, when you look back, and I don't think we've really had a bad guest. We've had a couple that had a little bit of stage fright, but they got over that pretty fast. But I think we've had a really good guest list, and many of those come from your direct suggestions. So one, thank you for being customers. You get what you pay for here at Midrats. And also thanks again for helping make the show better. And for those that just might be new to Midrats, you never know if a new person is going to come in for an anniversary show. If you'd like to listen to some of the previous shows with our traditional format, going over to Blog Talk Radio, you can listen to them all there. Or you can go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes and download it and listen at your convenience. We also have the chat room up and going with the usual suspects. And today we're going to probably tap into that maybe more than we usually do, though we do try to do that every show. If you don't feel like calling in, but you have observations or questions you'd like to ask, or a snide comment or two, the chat room is a great place to do it. But we're also doing something very different today. We do not have a dedicated guest. We are going to have a call-in, chat-in, and email-in show as a thank you to our regular listeners and some of our guests. If you go to the show page, you'll see the phone number there. If you want to call into the switchboard, call into the switchboard. I'll come talk to you for a couple of minutes, let you know if we have anybody else in the queue, see what you want to talk about, and then we'll bring you in like we would on any show. And if you don't want to do that, just put your question in the chat room. But we've got some people already lined up to talk today. And our regular listeners here will recognize this young man as well as people who spend time on the naval side of the blogosphere, Facebook. I think he's a maniac on Twitter. Even Big Navy decides to have Twitter wars with him, and they always come out bad. But our first guest is hailing to us until he PCSs out of there. Lucian, welcome to Midrats.
Oh, thank you, sir, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year, and it's always great to start the new year with the yeoman. Yeoman always worry me because you do know the words. But enough of me talking. We promised for this show that we wanted to turn the tables and let people ask us questions for a change. And just for the listeners to know, we have not prepped or pre-screened these questions, so we're kind of going to take them from the hip, just like we like other people to do. Lucian, what you have for Eagle One of me?
I guess I'd like to talk about all the nonsense that went on with Iran in the last week. In my mind, the last week must have underscored in the minds of all Iranian strategists that mining Hormuz or closing Hormuz in any sense of the word is not an option for them. They can't go ahead and play that card, both from what Fifth Fleet can do to mitigate any of their efforts, as well as the reaction from the larger world if they went ahead and mined it. That said, if you look at commentators like Fareed Zakaria, who are continuously opining about how the Iranian economy is in an abysmal state, they basically seem like they're singing that, you know, the swan song for the Iranian regime. I was wondering what y'all's take is on where Iran finds itself today.
Eagle One, you want to take it?
Well, I can start. Iran has a difficult problem. They are vulnerable to an export and import blockade, or, and as we call it, I guess, economic sanctions. And they're responding as that with threats. It helps jack up the price of oil before the sanctions go into full effect, and allows them to generate some more revenue while they figure out what they really want to do, and while they try and move as fast as they can to develop their, in my view, their first nuclear weapon. And you know, they can threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. It doesn't all belong to them, by the way. Oman happens to share that strait with them. And if they want to declare war on Oman, and then we're going to get, which they would essentially do if they close the entire strait by making Omani waters their waters, then Omani's allies, I would assume, would come to their rescue. We have a lot of other nations up the other end of the Gulf, Bahrain and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, who would like to use that strait too. You know, you get violations of international law. It's all kinds of excitement. And the question is, could the Iranians, at one point, the question is going to be, could the Iranians sustain a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz? And I think they could, a very brief period of time before a whole lot of stuff would happen to them that would put a halt to that operation. Back to you there, Sal.
I'm on the same sheet of music as you are. I mean, could they close the Strait of Hormuz if they wanted to? Sure, but it's a one-shot deal. I think, Lucian, you tapped on something there that Iran really needs to be careful when you decide to bluff. I think they did a bluff too far. Is the fact when people looked at it really close, yeah, they could do it. But without putting a single American soldier on the ground, if the president decided that he wanted to do it, Fifth Fleet, with maybe help from a dog and cat here and there, could pretty much eliminate all the naval assets and a fair bit of the air assets of the Iranian regime. I think what's interesting about it is economically and from a petroleum point of view, that Iran and the culture in the West that it hates are really in a death embrace, is the fact that they can't produce their own gasoline. They don't have the refining capability they need. The international community needs their oil, especially the Chinese, just to be able to keep the price at a reasonable level. And their demographics are very interesting, is they have a very, very young population. But unlike a lot of places in that part of the world, their youth are actually fairly well educated. One thing the mullahs didn't do after the 79 revolution was really get hold of their educational system as you would think they would. We saw a little bit of the uprising there. I don't think that has any potential to overthrow the regime anytime soon. But the potential is there that if things got really bad, which it would be with an embargo or any type of conflict that would dry up their supply of money, that they would have this very educated, very young demographic that is going to have to make a decision one way or another. So I think it was a bluff too far for the Iranians. As far as their nuclear capabilities, I'll let the Mossad figure that out. They probably got the best view of how close they are to getting a nuclear weapon. But I don't know if they get a functioning nuclear weapon and an arsenal to go with it, what we could do about it. I think it's just kind of a fait accompli to a certain extent. The only thing you're wondering about is the calendar. Was that close to answering what you wanted there, Lucian?
Yes, sir, it was. One additional thing I'm wondering in terms of this, though, is that it strikes me that Hormuz is, in essence, you know, it's almost like another theory of mutually assured destruction. Whoever moves first in terms of forcing the strait to be closed, either Iran going ahead and doing it first to make a point, or, you know, the U.S. taking any action against Iran, and then them, you know, their only recourse then to go ahead and close the straits. It all just paints the picture in my mind that it's a no man's land. In addition to that, sanctions. Fareed Zakaria was, he posted twice today on Facebook, very long post at that, in regards to the effect that sanctions are having. But the sanctions don't strike at their ability to go ahead and create their nuclear arsenal. People keep referring to them as, their money there went ahead and inflated from, I think, a dollar bought around 9,000 of their money to about 15,000 today in a span of time from when Obama first came office. That just strikes me as affecting their economy, but that doesn't tell me that it's affecting their ability to go ahead and develop a nuclear capability. So is it true that sanctions are going to go ahead and have to have a domestic effect on Iran for any larger effect to then go ahead and change their course of action towards developing nuclear weapons?
I think that there's a decouple there between their ability to have nuclear weapons and the impact of their economy. You know, history shows that nations under huge amounts of economic stress and even war can invest a lot of money in highly technical items if they want to. A nuclear weapon, it's mid 20th century technology. There's nothing super shocking about making a nuclear weapon. The hardest part about it is getting the intellectual capital that it takes to do the mathematics and the physics and getting hold of enriched uranium or plutonium, which they're well on the way to doing. The issue with their economy, though, and if you want to indirectly impact, if not their possession of nuclear weapons, but who might control the trigger, if the economic sanctions bite and there is some significant hardship in Iran, then you're helping to create the conditions for civil unrest, which plays into that young, relatively educated demographic who really doesn't hate America. People of a certain age who have a certain image of Iranians, which are there. You know, you see the video of the Revolutionary Guards. But people got to remember, one of the largest Iranian cities in the world is actually in Los Angeles. And I grew up and still have around me people of grew up in Iran. They're not a naturally hostile or angry people. And if they tap into that civil unrest, then maybe you get regime change. And with regime change, if they don't have a nuclear weapon, maybe they decide to invest their resources into something else. Or if there is a nuclear weapon, then maybe you have somebody that, if not friendly, at least is neutral, that's holding that trigger. Eagle One?
Yeah. I think we have to go back and look at the history of our relationship with Iran, which started out with a regime change that wasn't by popular support. And ever since then, we've been reluctant without a lot of support from the rest of the world to get ourselves involved directly in regime change with Iran. And if the population begins to hurt and they see that it's being caused by the form of government they have and they decide to do something about it, maybe the time is right for us to assist in some way, but we have to be very, very careful because last time, as I say, we assisted, we bought a lot of trouble down the road. And it's an extremely complicated question. So it's a good question for you to raise. I think that to go back to the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, that is kind of a double-edged sword. But the sharper edge of that sword, I think, is in the U.S. and allied forces' hand, and not in the Iranian hand.
All righty, we got two shots across the net, Lucian. Before you head off, and we pick up our next caller. Besides Twitter, is that the best place for people to keep tap on you? And I'm not teasing you about that, and I would recommend to all our listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, it's surface_sailor over at Twitter. Lucian has some very good links that he puts out there that's worth your time to follow him on Twitter. There's some I've enjoyed some of the things that you've linked to there. You've got a very diverse reading habit, which is good to pick some information up on.
I appreciate that, sir. And I'm sure I see, you know, Mary's there in the chat room, and all she's thinking is that I should be putting more stuff over at USNI vice my Facebook or Twitter. But, hit me up on Facebook as well. Truth be told, I do spend actually more time on Facebook. Slowly trying to get back into Twitter now, but, yeah, like you mentioned earlier, I kind of got into a little kerfuffle there the other evening with Big Navy, but, you know, anyways.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and Lucian, it's been nice communicating with you over the years, and I look forward to a few more.
Thank you, sir. Likewise.
All righty. That was some people know him as YNSN. Some people know him as Lucian. And we're going on to our second caller of today. He is both a friend of the flog, a friend of the flog, Freudian slip, a friend of the blog, a friend of the show. And he's also been a guest and always a good person to bounce some ideas off. Claude, good afternoon. Welcome to MidRaps.
Good afternoon. You know, it's always tough to follow Lucian. I was talking to him just before the show, and I think for your listeners that equally important to the CNO's reading list should be the Lucian Gauthier reading list, because he's one of the best read folks out there on naval and other issues, and I hope he writes a lot more about the stuff he's reading about.
And just a note to everybody, Claude is a Mainer, so he knows how to correctly pronounce French things, though they do pronounce Calais, Calais. And Montpellier is Montpellier, but when it comes to actual names, they do the French pronunciation. I can't figure it out. It must be the cold.
Thanks. And also, I want to congratulate both of you for 2 years of MidRats. You know, just for grins and giggles, I was looking at short-lived talk shows. That includes the Chevy Chase Show, the Magic Johnson Show, and the Late Show with Joan Rivers, and you've exceeded all of them, so I congratulate you.
Well, no plastic surgery, but that's all right.
All right.
And we've kept the same sponsors, too.
Our sponsors are very happy.
Okay, I'm going to keep this question a little broader for both of you. You've had a lot of shows the past 2 years. You've about over 100. You've had hundreds of blog posts between the two of you. What one incident or event or decision or person do you think has had the most positive impact to the Navy for the next 20 years, and also the most significant negative impact to the Navy for the next 20 years?
Are you looking for civilians or those in uniform?
It can be anything. Any single event, operation, decision, person, anything.
Okay. Let's see here.
You go ahead, Phil.
Yeah. No, I've got it. I'm gonna stick to those in uniform here. And one, it's going to be ethereal, and the other one, my regular readers won't be shocked who this is going to be a little more sharp-edged and to the point. And I think a lot of it has to do with personalities. I think over the next two decades or so, it's going to be a huge challenge. It's going to require a lot of intellectual work. Over at my home blog, I'm going to have a little post coming up here talking about a graphic that I got out of The Economist that shows various places that China is going to be overtaking the U.S. And just as kind of a double shot, I looked down there and said defense spending in real dollars in 2025. And I talked about the terrible 20s where a lot of the decisions that were made in the last decade, the missteps in shipbuilding and aircraft combined with recapitalizing the boomer is going to be a huge stressor on it. And you can add that shock of China exceeding our defense budget in the 20s as well to it. But for us to be able to do what we need to do, we need a very vigorous, intellectual, open discussion so that we can maximize what resources we have and with a realistic and honest and clear-eyed strategy to go with it. And that ain't going to take place behind closed doors like it may have in the past. That hasn't worked well over the last 20 years. I don't think it will. And in uniform, there's one person who has tried to get people to communicate more in the open. And I'm talking about Admiral Stavridis. And I would put right underneath him Admiral Harvey. And reason why I think he's going to have a long impact over the next 20 years is you have junior sailors and junior officers who saw a four-star that was willing to engage with people on a retail basis, and Admiral Harvey as well, were able to talk to them as individuals by us going through a four or five, and have encouraged people against a significant headwind to write, to talk, to get a discussion going, and to be willing to be an independent idea out there within reason. And I think that's going to be the most important thing that we're going to have in the next 20 years is a culture. And I think social media and the millennials who have grown up in that environment, which is it's communication, it's rapid, it's broad, it's diverse, it's not too deferential to central authorities. I think it's that type of creative friction and that type of intellectual churn that's going to help us reach the best solution that we can for the challenges that we're going to see in the mid-20s and going into to the 2030s. The person who I think has had the worst impact is the prior Chief of Naval Operations, Gary Ruffhead. Nice guy on a personal basis. People who've met him, you know, he's a very nice guy. I don't think he's a bad person. I don't think he's malicious. I just think he had some very, very corrosive ideas, some very bad programs, and very poor leadership, especially when it comes to accountability. When you look at the problems that we have right now in our shipbuilding, mostly, and some of our personnel policies, they all derive from either his direct ordering or direction, or an environment that he created. You look at LCS. You look at that huge problem that we had for that program, also DDG 1000, LPD 17 program, extremely expensive. And you also look at from the personnel side of view, where a Navy in a time of war had as its number one priority a political, social issue, which was basically affirmative action, capital D diversity. We came out of the fat years in worse shape than we had going in. You talk to people on the Hill. About 2 years ago, Admiral Ruffhead lost all credibility on the Hill, but he still remained a CNO, and we lost a lot of time and a lot of opportunity there. So nice guy, but I think his history will show his tenure as a Chief of Naval Operations was a huge opportunity cost. It was a huge loss for the Navy as a whole that will take a while to adjust and recover from. But that's just my opinion. Others will differ. Eagle One.
Yeah, I don't disagree with what you said. I do see I think the person, if I were to pick one individual who's going to have the biggest impact in the next 20 years, I have to go back in time, so in my way back machine, and pick Admiral Rickover. I think without his dogged determinism to turn as much of the Navy as possible to nuclear power, I don't think we would be anywhere near the position we're in as a global force for good, because we wouldn't have the assets and the capabilities we currently have, at least on the air side and on the submarine side. I think that, you know, if you stand on the shoulders of giants, he's a giant that we stand on the shoulders of, and I think that for the next 20 years, the next 40 years, as long as we have the kind of carriers we have and the submarine force we have to look back at him and go, you know, he was right. People were right to listen to him. People were right to put into effect the things he came up with. As far as the decisions that they're going to look at the next 20 years, I think the current refocusing of our forces to the Pacific is going to be a major impact on our service and on the future of this country militarily. And it's not overdue. It's a vitally important region for us. We have many allies out there. We have a lot of business interests out there. And there are many reasons we should be focusing on. And when I say the Pacific, I'm going to I'm including the Indian Ocean all the way back across to San Diego and Seattle coast. I think that decision being made by the current administration is a vital decision. Maybe any administration would have done it, but it's really important. I think the most negative thing that I've seen, and I don't really feel it's right to point at any given individual, because no individual is the product of himself, his or herself alone. It's the situation in which we place people and how they develop their careers and all that. But the worst decisions have to do with taking good ideas. Let's take the LCS. The LCS, as originally proposed, was a simple concept, and we've managed to completely ball it up by the add-ons. Somewhere we need to have the king of shipbuilding, who, like Rickover could do with his nuclear power program, who can look at something and go, you know, we're adding on to this ship capabilities it doesn't need, or we're not adding on capabilities it does need, and that person has to, or a group of people, and I noticed the usual suspect asked about the general board, which we've discussed in a previous show, and that the general board concept, you know, a group of people who really know ships and what the threats are and that sort of thing, could have come up with a far better vessel than this design, you know, a horse designed by a committee camel that we've ended up with. So I think whatever the structure was that got us away from having a czar of shipbuilding, that's probably the worst decision, and we're going to pay a price for that over the next 20 years unless we get a really fast turnaround on that concept. Does that answer that question for you, Claude?
That does. Those are both really extensive answers, and I appreciate them. Yeah, you know, just on the LCS issue, whenever I look at LCS and read something about it, all I can think of is a movie from about 15 years ago called The Pentagon Wars that starred Kelsey Grammer and Cary Elwes and a few other folks. And if, you know, your listeners want to understand what I'm talking about, just rent The Pentagon Wars, which I'm not sure. I think it was based on a true story loosely, but, you know, even if it's entirely fiction, having worked around the Pentagon, it could have happened. But anyway, thanks for your answers. And, guys, best of luck in future years with MIDRATS.
Well, thank you very much, Claude. And for those who don't know, Claude spends his quality time up in Annapolis. So say hi to the Midshipman Force.
Will do. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Claude. And by the way, when's our book coming out?
Last I saw it was February 7th, so within about 3 or 4 weeks you should have your copy. And Sal, what he's talking about is a book on maritime security companies, private market responses to piracy, terrorism, and other 21st century security challenges. And Eagle One provided a great chapter. Gordon Van Hook from Maersk contributed a chapter. So this is something that's entirely new, hasn't been out on before. So we're really looking forward to its release here in a few weeks.
Very good. We got a question on that topic coming up later. So good. We'll check everybody's grammar.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Take care. Okay, we do have another caller on the line, and I got to get rid of Claude first. Nothing personal. And here we go. AT1, good afternoon. Welcome to MIDRATS.
Afternoon, sir. Afternoon, Eagle One. How are y'all doing?
Great.
Doing quite well. Now, we had you on as a guest back in, was it late 2010 or was it early 2011?
Early 2011. The strategic LCPO or LPO first class sergeant thingy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, I didn't mean to steal your thunder, so well, what was your question?
Well, actually, I have two questions, and it relates to this recent budget announcement. One is, since we're concentrating back on PACCOM area of ops, do you think that we're doing the same thing the British did in 64 when it would be treated back to the west of the Suez? And two, since I was one of those lucky candidates, I'm being ERB'd out. Do you think that we're adversely affecting ourselves by cutting a large number of our strategic sergeants and strategic, our mid-level management in the enlisted ranks as we do this budget cut. Because, I mean, the way I'm seeing it up in my community, I mean, we're losing between 20 and 25% of the guys that were in the eligible candidates are being told to go home. And some of these guys are being dragged on 10-month deployments and then told to go home, which drinking beers and trading lunches with some of these guys, they're like, do I really want to do this, or can I just drop my paperwork and leave now?
Eagle One.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been as unhappy with a personnel decision. I mean, we went through this, something like this, in the late 70s when there was another, you know, the post-Vietnam era reduction in force. But this seemed to me to be handled extremely unwell. And in my experience in the Navy, a lot of the backbone of the fleet are the first and second class petty officers. And, you know, that's your technical knowledge base. And if they, you know, it's one of those things where I feel like we're cutting off our left hand because we don't know what to do sometimes, but then we'll spend, and what really irritates me is we'll spend a chunk of money on something like developing synthetic or, biological fuels in an unproven concept when we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars, when we could have kept people, I think, on good people, many good people on in the service a little longer and treated them more fairly in the way this thing was handled. So...
Yeah, the whole thing about ERB and PTS that bothered me the most. I mean, I didn't see the Vietnam era like Eagle One did, but I did see the post Cold War era, the peace dividend, and how things were done then. The detached manner at which this was very impersonal. That's the word I'm looking for. The impersonal nature of how this was done, well, you know, the logarithm will spit out our answers. That really pulls back. And AT1, I think you have the show on in the background. If you could mute that or get away from the microphone.
I'm kind of plugged into my computer because
I'll just try to concentrate a little better. No crisis. That's what bothers me the most, is the fact that we're letting people go, and a lot of these are, you know, 12 to 16-year career people, mid-grade petty officers, your experienced technicians, the ones that when the Fetzer valve got short-circuited by the flux capacitor and you still have to go in 20 minutes, you go look at your first-class petty officer. I had an EN1 once, who could almost smell an engine and tell you what was wrong with it. The incredible guy. Those are the type we've let go, and it seems like we've really focused on the meaty center of the people that have committed to the Navy to make this long deployment. And some people might call it anecdotal, but you're not the only one that's talked about the 10-month deployment. The people who have moved their family, just the forehead disappeared for 10 months while they're deployed. They found out, oh, okay, now I got to go home. And this isn't, speaking from personal experience, this is not an easy economy to get a job. I think there's a thematic problem as well, is the fact that we talk about how our sailors are our number one resource. We take care of our sailors. This builds cynicism because on its face, it doesn't. If you're going to fire somebody, I would much rather have a situation where every CO is told you got to cut X percent from each pay grade, and you got to make this decision in the next 8 months, and give COs the ability to make that call, than to have some computer spit it out. I also think that if you look at the response that our flag officer community had, there's no reduction at the top. It's all coming out of the center right now. Some reporting was done 2 weeks ago. About, in spite of the fact then Secretary of Defense Gates put out X number of cuts that didn't take place. There's actually been an increase in number. So where we're gutting out the center of our technicians, we are increasing the top. It's already top heavy as it is. I think it puts out a bad message to the fleet, to our sailors, and it really is ridiculous from a cost benefit point of view. Those excess side officers do not buy us what we need when we have a decreasing force level. The first part of your question also was about PACOM ops, and if we're doing something west of Suez, honestly, I don't think so. And Will Dossel, and I think we'll get to this question later on, he was Defense Strategic Guidance in 2012, and I put some thoughts out on my home blog about it as well. I think there's a lot of good there. Some movement needs to be done, some readjustments need to be done, but if you agree with it or not, if there's going to have to be cuts and efficiencies taken with the defense budget, then you have to prioritize. I think a focus towards the Pacific is a smart move. If you're going to allocate your resources, we're not abandoning the rest of the world by any stretch of the imagination. But nobody's going to be rolling through Southern Europe anytime soon. There are no more besides the FARC, and I wouldn't worry about Venezuela, because Hugo's about to assume room temperature here anytime soon anyway. Central South America aren't about to erupt in flames with Nicaraguan paratroopers landing in Montana or anything like that. So, where is our national security dollar need to be prioritized? That is where the soon-to-be the world's most strongest economy is. With strong economies comes resource requirements. When you have them surrounded by neighbors that hate them and have for millennia, then we need to focus there. So I think the emphasis to PACOM is just adjusting to the natural tides of national security requirements. Did that answer your question?
Oh, yes, sir, very much so. And I don't think we're doing the wrong thing when we readjust. I just question, because I think reading some history about the change, especially in the Mideast, when the Brits left Aden and left, basically all the Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, how the world basically kind of flipped in that region in the mid-60s and 70s. And I just wonder if Europe may not go through the same situation as we, I don't say retreat, but just look more towards the Pacific and leave the Europeans to their own.
Yeah, I think they have enough problems of their own to keep themselves focused for a while before they're going to go around anywhere else. Eagle One, did you have anything else?
Yeah, I think Mary made a good point in the chat room, which is that the cuts we're seeing are not unusual in the civilian world, at least in modern times. There was a day, and we saw this in the Navy too, Houston, you made a commitment, you were part of the family. And in the old days, corporations would keep you through good times and bad times because you were part of the family. And when the original owners of a lot of businesses sold out, and you've got professional managers in there, all became all about the bottom line, became all about numbers, and became less about the human beings involved in the institution. And then you began to see the kind of cuts and the reduction in forces that we've seen both in the civilian world and the military. And that's kind of a shame, because when I grew up in the military, as a military brat, we were part of a much larger Air Force family. In the Navy, we were part of the Navy family. And I think what hurts so much is we've allowed so many good people to believe they were part of a family, that they were major to the success of that family, and then tell them, your numbers don't match up. And I'm not even sure we told them exactly what numbers they should have been shooting for that would have helped them stay in. So that's what I'm really concerned about on that personnel side. And that's all I have to say about that. Thanks.
Yeah, I'll say one more thing before I go back over to AT1. And it's that I had an email from a couple people, and they're like, what's wrong with me? And there's nothing wrong with you. It's the logarithm that nobody can look at. Just have to spit you out. It's different than if you're sitting in front of your CO and your command master chief, and they go, I'm sorry, but we pick you for this reason, and you can have a more of a personal relationship. You can ask hard questions for the people who make the decision as opposed to it being detached. AT1, did you have anything else before we head on?
No, I think, just on the personnel thing, I think you're all right. And I'm, like I said, I was looking for the ERB thing, and I'm not angry about it. You know, I shook my hand at God when I found out about it for a while, and I had a few sea daddies, I guess would be the best term for it, a few friends who were in senior leadership contact me after they found out through the grapevine, and they basically laid out that you did nothing wrong, it's just this is what happens. But I really think, like you guys said, the impersonality just makes it harder to look at something. But I have nothing else to add right now.
Okay, well, we're keeping you on board the Midrats team one way or another. Hey, have a great new year, AT1, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks for calling in.
No worries.
Hey, my illustrious co-host there, Mr. Eagle One. I see him there in the chat room, but I understand you also have a question that our Turkish contingent has for us.
Yeah, he actually sent me 4 questions. And let's see. How about this one? Which how much attention can the U.S. government and the U.S. Armed Forces in particular, the U.S. Navy, really give to the Eastern Mediterranean in your, and let me expand that to, do we pay enough attention to what's going on in the Eastern Mediterranean as we go into this new world of energy being found off Cyprus, off Israel, and a place, some place off the Syrian coast? Your turn to answer.
Admiral Harry Harris, call your office and give us a call. Sixth Fleet. I think that's one of the most fascinating developments in the last, I don't know, 5 years, is the rather substantial hydrocarbon discoveries off of Israel, Lebanon, and Cyprus, which is nibbling near Turkey as well. Hydrocarbons can be a blessing or a curse. It can ruin you like Nigeria, or it can be a huge blessing like the Norwegians. Hopefully there'll be more Norwegian than Nigerian, though some of the countries there, you know how that works. I know there's the maritime boundary between Lebanon and Israel. There's some questions there, but I think possession is 9/10 of the law. The Israelis will keep that. I think the Cypriot question is going to be interesting because you have the Turkish part, you have the Greek part, you have the Turks, you got the Greeks. They don't play bocce ball well together. Hopefully their diplomats will be able to make sure that everybody gets enough drachma in their pocket and lira that'll keep everybody happy. Now, does the U.S. have enough to monitor what goes on in the Eastern Med? You throw what's going on with Egypt there, I don't think we're going to have any choice but to try to stay engaged. But Sixth Fleet is probably going to lean on our allies to do a lot, and a lot of little token visits as well. With that new PACOM focus, unless there's going to be a major conflict in Eastern Med, I think we're just going to let the diplomats and the businessmen work it out.
Yeah, first thing is, I think it's really amazingly great that these countries have found energy resources in their territorial waters, which helps diversify the sources of energy around the world and reduces the impact that a country like Iran can have worldwide once these resources are fully developed. Secondly, I think that the issues can work themselves out in time. There's a lot of money, and that's, money drives a lot of different crazy things, but if everybody gets a share, and the share is deemed to be fair, and how are you going to do that on international level? What's up if it's in your water? In your waters, it's your gas. Of course, the allies that we have, the two NATO allies we have in the immediate region are Greece and Turkey, and as you said, they don't always play well together. But the Russians have come down and are kind of snooping around the edges. I think the French have sent some assets out there to look around. this could be really interesting, the Eastern Med. I'm not sure what role the U.S. has to play other than our continuing relationship with Israel, our continuing relationship with Turkey, our continuing relationship with Greece. We have a lot of diplomatic stuff, and at this point I think this mostly looks like a diplomatic matter, not necessarily one that should be driven by our military capacity and capability, but it is something to keep an eye on, and it's a really potentially really interesting question, and maybe a potentially very hot spot.
Yeah, I think it's also a good example. You know, never write off a certain geographical area of the world of no longer being important. You know, I just made that mistake 10 minutes ago. I said, oh, well, you know, in Europe, they're not going to be doing anything to each other. They got plenty of their own problems. You know, just despite me, and a year from now, there could be something very funky going on in Europe. You just never know. I think the key there is, even if we continue what I think is the right move, the Cold War is over, World War II is over, no reason to have 10,000 troops in Italy unless you're doing one heck of a shore call and want to do some drinking, and you know, six figures of people hanging around Germany. I said it 10 years ago, I'll say it again, decouple and come home. But the important thing is to have the infrastructure in place so that if you do need to flex and you do need to build, you can do that in various parts of the world. And I think you do that through having, with our allies, some joint combined logistics and training facilities, kind of like what we have in Grafenwehr, Lakenheath, a few other places here and there where we work with our allies so that we can flex if we need to, as opposed to having a permanent presence there. And somebody made a snarky comment that, oh, you're just saying that because that supports, you know, the Navy's global reach logistics with the Air Force. I was like, well, okay, fine, if you want to accuse me of being parochial, but I don't know, having strategic airlift and sea lift that can go anywhere in the world, I think, is a lot smarter for a maritime nation to do than garrisoning free countries with tens of thousands of your young men and women. Just seems kind of silly to me. You said Saturn V had five questions. Well, let's spread the wealth around. We got one. I also have a couple of questions from people here. I figure we'll just scatter it around. Let me throw one out for you from our buddy Herb Carmen. And I like this question because it kind of makes us think about ourselves here. And his question is, why hasn't the Navy's version of Colonel Paul Yingling come to the front about the failures of basically what Yingling did? Is he talked about the failure of having a culture of accountability in the general officers. And why doesn't the Navy have somebody like Yingling that holds our senior leadership to account? And what will it take to create one?
Well,
I think you could throw McMaster and Nagel in that mix too.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you and I have discussed the beauty of the bull captain, the captain who knows he's not going to make admiral, and therefore is freed up to a certain extent from playing the political games. And I think that what we've lost somewhat is I don't hear many of those O6s speaking out about this very topic, which, you know, where's the guy who says, I'm going to hold my boss accountable. This, you know, this can't go on this way. And, you know, in theory, this all ought to be done through our inspector general shop, I guess. I'm not sure how that supposed to work. Usually that's for fraud, waste, and abuse. But these things, these mistakes that get made, and then the person gets promoted, and there is no consequence to his or her career, that is very troubling. And that really, in my view, is whereas, as Ken says, there aren't any old bold captains anymore, but, you know, there ought to be a place for those old bold captains to speak out and say this is just simply wrong. And, you know, what are they going to do to them? You know, at some point you've got enough years in and enough longevity, they can't do anything to tell you to go home and shut up and in which case all that does is give you a, probably access to more TV networks to talk on.
And you know, I think the ironic thing is when I the personalities that, that Herb is talking about and that I would love to see, the Navy that I grew up in, we used to make fun of the Army mostly because they were a bunch of unimaginative automatons who were almost Soviet in their bureaucracy and their lack of inventive thought. But actually, the Army culture created, and there's more than just those three guys, that's just the top three that comes to mind. And Paul Yingling put the general officers on report when he was a lieutenant colonel. McMaster, you know, he pinged on the Vietnam generation, and I know that Petraeus had to lean heavily on a board to get him to make brigadier, and Nagel pulled a salamander and punched out at about 21 years. So the Army took those hits and still promoted these guys, and a big heartbreak, you know, you talk about the bull captains, I love those guys, but one of my great heartaches is, I was a recidivist staff weenie. I had a great bull captain as a chief of staff, and I watched him on the phone with another bull captain who was a CSO on a lower staff. And they were in conversation about a significant ethics violation that the community's number three flag officer had done 2 years in a row involving a board. And they were discussing what to do about it. And in the end, their decision is, well, we're not going to do anything about it because for reasons one, two, and three, he'll survive it like he survived the other things, and it's just not worth it. And I think we just need to reach a point that we have those bull captains who go, this needs to be said. It needs to be said by somebody in uniform that has some gravitas. Is that the word? And I think that's what we're looking for. And what will it take to happen? Either the right personality shows up at the right time and feels that it's worth it and is given a platform at which and is articulate about it, or there is something very egregious that happens, hopefully it doesn't cost lives, it creates a crisis in the culture which draws out three or four or five of them to really have an internal come to Jesus meeting about what our senior leadership needs to do in order to properly execute its duties and its responsibilities to make sure this nation has a maritime force that can carry out the National Command Authority's direction with what resources it has. So I guess we're just waiting for personalities or events to make that take place. I don't know, maybe there's somebody out there who is working on their doctoral dissertation and on leadership, and that dissertation will turn into a book, and hopefully we can get them on Midrats to talk about it, but I think we're just waiting.
Yeah, I'm kind of disappointed of the things that get published in proceedings, and this, which should be the, and I'm going to say this carefully, that proceedings, if there were O6s who were unafraid of the consequences of telling what they know or what they believe they know, and this is in terms of national strategy, not on personal wrongdoing on some flag or anything, but just, you know, where's the guy writing, where's the O6, active duty O6 writing, LCS sucks, if that's what he believes. And, you know, that's kind of what I think that some of these, we have the places to say that, but we don't necessarily have the people who have the driver motivation or whatever to come out and say that.
Yeah, and that's a shame because I mean, he was retired 05 at the Army War College, but you know, John Patch put out an LCS article that Undersecretary Work got worked up about, but in a good way, I think, is that he talked about it in public, and yeah, but that was about it. But it's going to take somebody I think, who's a captain and is still on active duty, who's willing to flop it on the table there and say, look at it, and get some friction going there. Next question. We have two from him, but we'll save the other one for later. B.J. Armstrong managed to push some stuff through the nipper net tubes to us. And he goes on to one of our little hobby horses, but I know on some of the post shows, Eagle One, you and I have talked about this in length, and I think it's a good thing to talk about again. And BJ's question has to do with the fact that we're looking – right now we know that LCS is scheduled to replace both our mine warfare ships and our PCs, and that effectively gets rid of our operational – 03 and 04 commands. There are rumors swirling about that LPD 17 is going to become an 06 major at sea command. And kind of a three-part question he has after setting that environment. He said, first of all, is this a reaction or a backlash against all the reliefs that we've had of COs and XOs recently? And is this increase in experience, if measured in years of duty, a good thing for the Navy at these commands? And where and when should officers begin experiencing the ultimate responsibility that comes with command at sea?
Well, as you and I have discussed, I keep thinking that we need to push command down as low as possible. And it's a shame that we have so many expensive ships, including the LCS, which we don't want to put in the hands of an 03 or 04 and give him a chance to ding it up. I mean, in the minesweeping world, in the old days when we had lieutenant commands and there were other ships that were Lieutenant JG commands and all that, you learned how to drive ships. I had a CO on a destroyer who was what they called the mod squad. He was a lieutenant commander, skipper on a destroyer, and he had a command before. He'd had a minesweeper that was his first command, and during that command, he'd gotten into a gunfight off the coast of Vietnam with a trawler of unfriendly nature, and managed to get in a shoot up and ended up with a Silver Star. Now, you know, he was a great CO. He had been through the early trauma of command, and by the time he got his second command, he was he was experienced. He knew what to sweat and what not to sweat, and he was wonderful to work for. And he trained his junior officers very, very well in the important things about you need to know to drive ships and to fight a ship. And I think that kind of thing is almost invaluable. If this trend continues, though, that every command has to be an 06 command, we're going to have rear admirals commanding aircraft carriers and Lord knows what we're going to do with other issues. But I think it's a real shame. We need to allow junior officers to get out there and bang the ship up against the pier and not get them fired for that. And, this, as somebody notes, the zero defects is the issue. We have to get away from that and get back into allowing our young officers to have some commands. And I would I've already discussed this before. I would buy a bunch of cheap little leftover offshore oil field boats and give them to lieutenants to drive around the ocean and fight pirates. Okay, Ken Adams has a question.
Yep, let me respond to BJ's question, then we'll bring Ken on. The He's now president or CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, but Admiral Cutler Dawson, on his wall, he had command pennants of all the ships that he commanded. And his first command was an ocean-going tug as a lieutenant. And one of our usual suspects thinks that everybody should be civilian mariners, and I think that that's a good place at all. But there's an opportunity cost. Okay, you save 10% or whatever the number is by having civilian managers, another Freudian slip, civilian mariners on board ships. But what do you lose? What is the opportunity cost? The opportunity cost is experience for command at sea. There, the only way to know whether somebody is going to be a really good CO of a cruiser is if they are really good COs beforehand. So with we've moved these away from these smaller ships, what we now call a destroyer, you've seen me throw this out before, is not a destroyer. An Arleigh Burke is a light cruiser. DDG 1000 is a gun cruiser. We really do not have any mid-sized ships. We have a small ship called an LCS that is just a large corvette that's a commander command. 100 people, and you got a commander commanding it. That's just absurd. And so we shouldn't be surprised that we've got great inflation, experience creep. We have O5s commanding what should be O4 commands. And a lot of that driving that is bureaucratic. You have a system that selects in your own image. So you have to have certain career gates that you have to meet. And, you can't be CO as a lieutenant and a lieutenant commander. You won't make the following gates, which is absurd in a service that's supposed to be about going to sea. I don't know how you fix that unless you totally change the way things go and we have a different mix of ships. I think LPD 17 becoming a major command is foolish. World War II, a lot of it was by necessity, but I think the CAGS is 37-year-old O5s. They did a fine job, and even after World War II, that was true. I just think it's a horrible lost opportunity. If you look to the Coast Guard, those guys have command over and over and over again. It would be nice to be able to develop a career path that lets people get that experience. Because if you have people who are COs as lieutenants, lieutenant commanders, and you can actually be maybe an XO as lieutenant commander, a radical thought, when people actually get in command, I think you're going to see better airmanship, better seamanship, better leadership, and maybe less people laid off. But that's a parallel universe. We have on the line one of our usual suspects. I'm very glad that he's come on board with a question. Ken Adams, welcome to MidRats.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Hey, given the discussion about, you know, where is the guy who is willing to stand up in the Navy and challenge the leadership, and the kind of the fear of retribution that is perceived on those folks, I note that a lot of the discussion about the Navy happens in sort of anonymous or semi-anonymous forums. For example, the comments on everybody's blogs, where you can choose to be who you want to be. Some of us have, for a long time, used our own names and been out there. And, some started out anonymous and then decided to come out and name their own names. And I wonder what is your thought on that kind of an environment where people think that they don't have the safety that they need to be able to speak up and just use their own names. So I'd like to get reaction from Eagle One on that first due to his recent status change.
Yeah, I started blogging anonymously. I'm trying to think of the reason I did that, but I just didn't want to hassle with having my real name known at the time. And recently, after taking a look at that and the fact that I just thought I was being foolish. I mean, people knew who I was. I wasn't really keeping it very much of a secret. I'm a retired guy, and there's not much anybody can do to me. It would be it would take a lot more, you know, I wish, as now, of course, I wish that I had been a little more proactive on this stuff when I was more active in the reserves or on active duty, but, you know, I see a lot of things now in my rearview mirror that I wish I'd done differently. As far as any feedback I've had as a result of people knowing my real name, I haven't gotten any, none. So, you know, the fear of retribution had to do not necessarily with fear of retribution with anything in the Navy. There were some other aspects of things I was blogging about that I had some trepidation about, but I think those things have gone, were overblown in my own mind, and I kind of regret not even having started out using my real name all along. Well.
Yeah, obviously, Mr. Anon, myself. You know, when I first started blogging in 2004, and anybody's at liberty to go back and see the reason I put there back in, I think it was July of 2004, it was really kind of a therapy for me because at the time, one of the side jobs that I had that really kind of set me off was I was editing other people's work that was being submitted for publication to ensure that it met the goals and aspirations and priority of the first flag officer of the chain of command, to the point that people were calling me up and saying, forget that. No, not interested. Just pull the article. I'm not going to do it if you're going to take those paragraphs out. And, I had a couple of ideas of things that I wanted to publish as well, and I was told no. I said, okay, that's fine. And the blog sphere back in 2004 really wasn't that big. And so I said, I'll just go up there and throw out some ideas. And I was anon at the time for two reasons. One, I was hitting on some subjects that aren't really suitable for public viewing. And I didn't want to get my boss in trouble, didn't want to get myself in trouble. And I liked the anonymity point of view because that way the people that worked for me and I worked for didn't have to worry about getting phone calls saying, what's this schmuck you own paper for disagreeing with my policies? And, you know, I've retired over 2.5 years ago. And as some of y'all know, I'm not purely anonymous anymore. I've kind of come out of the closet, but I haven't fully come out of the closet. I guess I've gotten comfortable with my alter ego. I've gotten a little comfortable with the branding point of view. But now that I'm no longer on active duty, there's no worry that the guy that I work for is going to be put in an uncomfortable situation or that the people that work for me who may disagree with me on one, a political topic or something like that manner are going to have, is that's going to cloud our working relationship. So I've come out of the closet a little bit. There's a lot of the regulars who know who I am in the real world, and frankly, I don't care anymore. But I've just kind of gotten comfortable in this skin. The reason why I was anon, besides those that I mentioned, was the fact those phone calls take place, and they take place because I used to make them. Sal, go call so-and-so. I want to talk to Lieutenant Commander Umpty France about his submission. That puts a whole chain. When you put something out in some environments, not all environments, it's not every chain of command is like this. It's really leadership dependent. They will come down hard on anything that is contrary to a direction they want to go in. And in order to publish your ideas, you have to keep it on the down low. And, you know, Will, you're asking about, you know, where is the Paul Yuengling? And I still find it ironic that, you know, you got Yuengling and Nagel and McMaster's made a bunch of stuff that came out of the Army culture. I think it really takes articulate people who are willing to have larger cojones and better writing talents than I did. And go, hey, I'm gonna publish this, roll it up, stick it in your forehead, and we'll be off and running. And you know, Admiral Stavridis says that when he started writing, that his bosses got some uncomfortable phone calls, but he had the top cover. And maybe there are some individuals that are close to coming out, but they look to see whether they have top cover. Do they feel confident? I never had top cover at any point when I was on active duty. I knew right where the stake was going to be inserted and which flagpole my body was going to be gibbeted at if I published something that wasn't pre-screened. But not all chain of commands are like that. So we're waiting for somebody who feels like they got the top cover. Either that, or they're kind of like the bull captains who go, I just got back from a 12-month IA. What are they going to do? Cut my hair and make me have a 45-minute commute and work 10 hours a day? Well, okay, fine. And they're willing to pull that out. Did that answer your question, or did I go down a rabbit hole somewhere, Ken?
No, that's kind of what I was interested in. The other thing that came up that Lucienne just posted in the chat room is, you know, the discussion of how ideas get identified to the person that publishes it. And I think that's important for whoever's going to be that Navy Yingling. And they're going to have to build that reputation, just like you've done on the anonymous side, in order to generate the credibility.
Yeah, I think there's a part of the deal. I mean, I'm sitting there looking at Yingling, and I'm not sure how I know that Nagel got out of the Army. And I'm not sure where McMaster's is now. I guess, is he a brigadier? I mean, you know, it's, if you know you're leaving the service, if you know some, you know, sometimes maybe it's easier to be less anonymous. And I think McMaster's and Nagel both, their papers were part of something they were doing for a war college somewhere, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, the people that I admire are the ones who actually took the stand. And if my only career had been in the military and I was in the position I was in, I probably would not have been anonymous. But I had another thing going on that I really had to do at that time to, I thought, be anonymous. But I admire you, Ken, for not taking the anonymity route. And you've put your opinions and your beliefs out there where everybody can see them. So good on you, and I'm glad to join that club.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to add this little note, too, that'll add an angle. Somebody made a comment a couple of weeks ago. It's like I kind of painted myself in a corner with the personality that my alter ego has over at the other blog. Is Midrats is more me. The blog over there developed a life of its own. So, you know, you look back, how would I have done things differently? Part of me would have intentionally ignored some of the topic areas that I hit on a regular basis. But the other half of me goes, no, because I've gotten some really good results from airing that. And I've helped some people by airing a few topics that have made some significant hate mail and enemies, but it produced more good on overall than it did negative feedback for me. So, yeah, sometimes you get painted into a certain personality type and a certain topic set by being a little more free in your thoughts than you would otherwise.
That's great. Thanks, guys.
Hey, you're welcome, Ken. And, hey, have a great new year.
You too.
Thanks, Ken.
And I know there are more people out there listening who want to call in. We didn't want to put Ken on the spot, but we had to use my two favorite leadership tactics, fear and shame. Not too much fear, but a lot of shame.
Actually, yeah, there was a lot of shame there.
Oh, you're still on. Yeah, I think I shamed you, didn't I, Ken?
Yeah, you questioned my masculinity.
Yeah, so hey, if Ken can call in, and by the way, your voice isn't half as dorky as you think it is. If Ken can call in, anybody can call in. So if you want to, we got plenty of questions here that we can cover. But if you want to call in, please do call in. We got open lines. Let's see, we got through with BJ's question. Because we just touched on it a little bit, Eagle One, Will Dossel, another guy who fully came out of the closet, otherwise known as Steel Jaw Scribe, he couldn't call in today. But what he did is he wanted us to look at the Defense Strategic Guidance 2012 that came out. And he kind of asked the question this way. Is this in many respects a reset to the 2001 QDR that was OBE? Eagle One?
Yeah, you want to go again? I was looking up the definition of something these modern internet terms just are new to me. You know, in fact, I'm hand cranking my computer now.
We'll have head tappy to belly rubby practice later. The Defense Strategic Guidance 2012 that came out, does that look in many respects almost like somebody hit the reset button on the 2001 QDR that came out the month before the 9/11 events? And have we just basically gone back 11 years to a view that we were starting to develop at that time?
Yeah, and I guess there's a reason for that. My thought is that if we declare peace with the I've been through this before. I feel like Fiat something. If we declare peace with the militant Islamist world by pretending they don't exist, I guess we go back to the pre-9/11 world. And what better way to do that than going back to the pre-9/11 strategy?
Yeah, I can kind of see where he was coming from that angle, but not just the lower force levels. And I think the lower land force levels kind of make sense because we plussed them up anyway when we were in Iraq. We never really plussed them up enough, but that's in the past. I think the die is cast with Afghanistan. The president's going to bug out of there in 2014, regardless of what happens. And he's the commander-in-chief. That's what he wants to do. The momentum there is so strong that's going to take place. So it's going to be logical that we're going to have lower land force levels. The reset back to 2001, that was, in my memory, nobody really knew what to do in 2001. So maybe that's not a bad analogy, except that I think we have a better idea what we need to do now than we did before. We'll just have to see. But I think I was actually surprisingly pleased with the document, mostly because it gives Congress enough running room to do what needs to be done. And it made sense. I didn't see anything in there that really, really, I said, what in God's creation are they thinking about? I thought it was a pretty pretty straightforward document.
Yeah, I tend to think that if we're smart, and of course that's a big if, we will keep as much as we can, in the Army and the Marines, the extremely experienced young sergeants that we have who have been at war for 10 years because they are the people who they're probably going to be the worst garrison soldiers in the history of the world. I mean, warriors tend to be horrible at garrison type stuff, but they're the backbone of the force that we would need if we ever had to call up another army to go do stuff. And I hope we're smart enough to keep the best of that group. I hope, because I hope in the Navy that we're smart enough to keep the best of the E5, E6. And of course we have different ways to promote people, but I hope we're smart enough to keep that group around because they're the ones who've been at war for 10 years, and they, quite frankly, that's something you cannot get without very painful experience. And we've got the best experienced Army and Marines in the world right now.
You know, and you could argue that from a education point of view, a behavior on the battlefield point of view, and just sheer ability to inflict violence on a per capita basis is one of the most powerful military forces ever fielded. But you made a really good point. There's going to be an adrenaline letdown here from these multiple deployments, both as an institution, but also on a personal basis, as people try to readjust to garrisons and exercises and garrisons. Will be interesting. Hey, unless you have a recent question from the chat, I got not somebody online, but we have a different question sent by a different person.
Works for me.
Okay. this is from our friend Lee, and he sent us two questions. We'll go with the first one, and something to stroke our ego a little bit here. Here's his first question. Do you feel that your mil-blogging efforts have had any impact on the naval situation or structure? Sure, your opinions are good to hear and well thought out, but other than expressing them, to what end is mil-blogging in your opinion?
Quite frankly, I don't know whether, and I don't know when we would know or if we would know, from my perspective, if anything I've written has meant anything to any, but feedback from the merchant marine world that some of my stuff has been useful to them. And, you know, but if I had set out to write the blog as, you know, I'm going to impact the world, I'm going to make a difference kind of thing, I think I would, my attitude toward it, I probably would have quit a long time ago. Like you, this was more therapeutic for me, and it really helps me keep, I think, focused on things that are happening out in the world. And, it, you know, topics I write about, things that I enjoy writing about or reading about and learning about. So if that has an impact on other people, and I would be happy to know that it has, then I'm very grateful. If it hasn't had an impact on anybody other than me, then, you know, I'm happy with that, too. So I appreciate the question. I hope that some of the conversations that I've started in my blog or you started in your blog have been useful to other people.
Yeah, the whole thing of a blog is a web log, almost a diary of thoughts. And as a byproduct, yeah, I think early on in the blog, I know we had, and what's interesting is the readers that you get, or even the listeners here that we get, is kind of humbling. I go, oh my God, I need to check my grammar a little better and not stutter as much. It's humbling that certain people will actually read my dribble or will listen to our show and then send me emails like, wow, that's pretty cool. I know that we had an impact early on to bring Riverine Forces on. A lot of that was because had some communications with some people up on the hill who just called and asked for information. So responsible for things? No, but helped out? Yeah. I think a voice and a place to get published for people that really don't have a voice or any place to get things published or ideas or issues, I think that's been useful as well. I think people have heard me use this term before. There's a information ecosystem out there. And we fill a certain niche in the ecosystem that wasn't being filled before, simply from a structural and a cost point of view. Ron Paul's newsletter, I guess, would be a blog nowadays that he's gotten in trouble for. But we're just part of the information infrastructure. But mostly, I enjoy it because of the communications that I have with other bloggers, the people who comment and email me on a regular basis. I find it intellectually stimulating. If that helps move the conversation forward in some marginal percentage, all the merrier. But yeah, just like you, Eagle One, I'd still be pushing stuff out there even if nobody cared. Simply to push it out there. He also had I thought it was a second question, but it was actually just kind of a follow-up, I think. I owe it to Lee to do this because he offers his own follow-up without hearing our question. I wish I could imitate Lee's bearded voice in doing this, but he says, does the U.S. Navy actually give a damn what we say? I know there are a lot of – I know that there are those senior naval officials who have attempted to embrace social media, but do any of them listen to the noisy crew?
Yeah, I think – I mean, I do think we get listened to, and I do think that we cover something, an area of the world of information that is undercovered. I think one of the things that I'm happy with that we do, both of us do, is we provide information about the importance of the United States Navy. We provide the importance about information about the importance of navies in general. We provide information to people who are interested in international commerce and the flow of commerce and choke points and why we do things the way we do them as far as national strategy, why our ships are deployed the way they are, what the threat, you know, I'll go back. I've been writing about piracy for, 7 years or something. You know, there are a lot of issues that we address that I don't think had been addressed before. And you know, we may not offer the definitive answer to a lot of those issues, but if somebody wants to know, you know, what's a choke point, what's the sea lane of communication, what's you know, what is the importance of the Groben or wherever that ship was that got chased around the Mediterranean until it ended up in Istanbul at the start of World War I, you know, they can find that answer somewhere in either one of our blogs. And that has been fun for me. That, you know, I mean, I enjoy getting that kind of information and putting it out there. And I think that when we talk, I think we've both written about the importance of the sea lift capability and logistics in the tsunami, the Christmas tsunami, or in New Orleans after Katrina, in fact, the whole U.S. Gulf Coast after Katrina. So I think a lot of those issues and trying to keep a Navy-centric focus, push that forward, I think that our blog's been used for that. And I'm trying to remember the name. There was another Navy blogger who stopped. He got a job where he couldn't do it anymore, but I can't remember. What was his name? He was in Iraq fairly early on. Oh, boy. Anyway.
Lieutenant Smash?
Yeah, Lieutenant Smash. You know, and
I miss him.
Yeah, me too. And he told me at a MIL blog conference, he said, you know, it's up to you guys to carry this, and I think that's a very serious charge. And although I do what I do because I enjoy doing it, there's also that aspect to it that, you know, some of this stuff needs to be said and things need to be pointed out. So to the extent that we do that, good for us, and thank you all for being listeners or readers of our blogs and of this crazy radio show.
Yeah, you brought up, when you mentioned Lieutenant Smash, that he's one of the guys that helped encourage me to keep blogging after I started in 04. You know, there's him, there's Greyhawk from Mudville Gazette was really big, John from ARG. I used to comment over.
I got my clue band here someplace.
I used to comment under a different name over at his place before I ever really started blogging on my own. And totally divorced from the military, really, was the corner over at National Review. I was in a regular email contact with a few of the writers over at National Review, and they put some of my comments as my actual self up there on the corner. I was like, hey, people are actually reading what I have to say. That's pretty neat. So, I mean, do people care? One of the funny things, and I have to give kudos to the Naval Institute for this and some of their conferences that I've gone there as my alter ego. Undersecretary Work, he knew me. He talked to me about some of my recent posts. Admiral Stavridis laughed and said, I thought you were some super secret guy. And I was like, oh, not anymore. I'm retired. And yeah, he asked me a bunch of questions about my personal self. And I answered every one because he's Admiral Stavridis. And plus, I was retired at that point. Anyway, and I had some good conversations with Admiral Harvey. And I went, oh, my God, they actually read my stuff. And a couple of times, I got stuff wrong. Embarrassingly wrong in one case, and Admiral Harvey called me out on it. So I was counseled by him, deservedly so. They do read us. I think some of the conversations I've had with people besides those individuals, they've just been polite. I think there's a large portion of people who are dismissive of us, don't like us, wish we would shut up. But there are also some people that understand that we're just part of the information ecosystem, and it's better to you know, keep your enemies closer than further away, though they really don't see us as enemies. We're just nuisances. But on average, yeah, I think they do, as long as, and this is true, and that's what I love about the commenters and emailers, they keep us honest. If what you're putting out there is accurate, it's pretty well grounded, you can back up your opinions with something that's reasonably attuned with Newtonian physics, and you don't get excessively personal, then yeah, they'll pay attention to you. But if you just come off as some quack who wants to convert everybody back to coal-powered ships, then you're going to be ignored. But there is that feedback loop in the online world that I think that we experience more than people who just write on Dead Tree don't really experience. Because if you put something out there that's incorrect, like you identify a Ticonderoga-class cruiser as an Arleigh Burke, you'll have 800 know-it-alls tell you inside of 30 seconds. And for the real serious things, people will correct you as well. And I think that's a neat thing about the blogosphere, is if you have a good stable of regular readers, I call them the front porch, and emailers, they'll keep you honest. And they're not sycophants. Nobody likes sycophants. Nobody likes trolls. But after a while, you develop a good salon, and they help keep you honest, and they give you good ideas for posts as well.
What? Okay. What else you
okay.
Got?
Hey, enough of my soliloquy there. Let's look at Saturn V's second question that you have there.
Well, let's see. Well, we got since I managed to shift to a different computer here.
A true geek.
Will they fight against piracy in the Gulf of Aden finally make a landfall, or will it stay wet?
Oh, wow. If I had to bet a guided quail hunt in southern Georgia, I would say there's stuff already going on the ground. We just don't know about it. And plus, we've even had a few unplanned and ungraded naval gunfire exercises that have gone on. I think the correct move and the right move is a little bit of direct action when it's really called for on the ground for short duration. But most of the things that we're going to do is rightfully, I think, at sea and near shore. We're not going to be able to make effects on the ground besides taking out individuals and capabilities and perhaps doing some rescue if need be. From an anti-piracy point of view, I'm sure we'll read about it in a decade or so. Hopefully the CIA is doing what needs to be done, and special warfare is doing what it needs to be done when it needs to be done. But I don't think from anti-piracy we need to have any type of boots on the ground for anything that can be measured more than a few hours.
Yeah, I think you know, this is somewhat prompted, I think, because the Germans recently discussed whether or not they would go dry with, you know, some of the operations should end up on land, and you know, that's been a topic of conversation for some time, and I think, you know, we, as you already know, we've had the French go ashore, we've had some close-in activity by other countries that have gone in and burned some boats fairly close to the beach, and, you know, I'm sure they've done a lot of other things. The Brits, I believe, were involved in some of those things. For the most part, you know, it's going to be a seaborne thing, and I think we've had a couple of really interesting adventures here recently. One was the takedown of the Iranian, the captured Iranian fishing vessel by the Stennis and its attendant cruiser destroyers, and the other takedown, the Danes got another Iranian, partially Iranian crewed fishing vessel or some kind of vessel off Somalia here reported today and freed 14 hostages. So as long as they can capture the motherships, as long as they can keep destroying the skiffs when they find them, then I think a lot of it's going to stay at sea, because it's just nobody, I still don't think anybody's really ready to get involved to the extent that it would take to be involved in Somalia to put an end to the conditions that create the piracy as we now know it. Now, Saturn V does point out that there's, you know, been, we've got the Kenyans and a bunch of other people kind of involved in on the ground in Somalia, and that may be the extent that we're willing to do anything, is perhaps providing some funding. I don't have any way of knowing whether that's true or not, but whether we're funding or at least approving of such operations as they try and straighten out the mess that's created by what's gone on here recently in Somalia with the current Islamist group that seems to be worse, the Shahababs, or they are, that seem to be the worse than some of the other groups. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think and Saturday's one question actually folds in real well to B.J. Armstrong's second question, and very much parallels it. And BJ's second question is, so far this pirate season, the average number of attacks is roughly holding steady, but there's been a decrease in successful pirate attacks where they've been able to seize a ship. He said some analysts are saying this is due to increased number of deployments by naval forces, and an increased number of security teams being used on board ships. And he says, how should naval forces view this success? And should naval forces view be different than the maritime community as a whole?
Well, how do you measure success? I mean, if we're going to claim that we somehow throttled piracy, then you'd expect the numbers to go down, but the numbers are holding steady. Therefore, I guess we conclude the pirates are either smarter than we are and have expanded their operations into areas that aren't covered, which we know to be true, because if you look at the map, it used to be attacks fairly close inshore to Somalia and off some of the islands, and in the Gulf of Aden has now spread across the Indian Ocean, down off the coast of, down in the Madagascar Strait and a whole bunch of other exciting places. So we see both things. We may have cut back on piracy at certain levels, but all that's caused to do is the pirates, just like squeezing the toothpaste tube. We just have squeezed the tube in one spot, and some of the stuff has moved to other areas. Also, I don't think we've fully seen the effect yet of what would happen if all or more merchant ships had armed security teams on them. As far as I know, as of today, not a single armed merchant ship has been taken by pirates. Your thoughts?
And that makes perfect sense. They're like any criminal enterprise. They're going to go for the easy target. If they approach a target that looks difficult, they'll back off and say, we'll get the next one. This isn't worth it. And this is a constantly evolving thing. They have a certain tactic. We do a counter tactic. They counter that. I think it goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago from Saturn V's other question about going ashore. The ultimate solution for this is eventually you got to run out of pirates, or you have to run out of the economic incentive to be a pirate. And that all has to be done ashore. Does the international community have the will to do that? I'll tell you one thing, that the Germans may talk it, based upon my experience with them in Afghanistan. Germany's not going to do anything. Are you kidding me? The minute one of them goes in there and a spare round kills Uncle Fred's goat, the German press is just going to have a heart attack, and then their military will tuck their tail back between their legs and go back out 100 miles off the coast and eat bratwurst. There's theory and there's practice. The French have no problem getting wet. Neither do the Brits. We'll do what needs to be done, but it's all a little bit here and there. The only way to take out the pirates is the same way that it was done in Roman times, same way it was done 200, 300 years ago. You have to go there. You have to kill people and break things ashore. Otherwise, at sea, all you're doing is reacting. And I think we're just in the reacting phase now. And if the best reaction is to get a bunch of Argentine and hope that all of a sudden the Somalis decide to become Buddhist, then hey, that's great. But that's just waiting, waiting and seeing. So the economic and the philosophical reasons to be pirates haven't changed. So I think this is just going to be an evolution of move, counter move at sea until somebody decides to get serious.
Yeah, and part of the problem, too, and I think I've certainly discussed this before someplace, is that the crews of the ships that are being taught are not Danes, they're not Germans, they're not the French, they're not really Brits. I mean, what we've got in the international shipping industry are ships that may be owned and flagged in different countries, but the crews are oftentimes poor Indians, Bangladeshis, Filipinos. If a ship full of Americans or Brits or Germans had been caught by these pirates and they were maltreating them the way they're maltreating the prisoners they currently hold, I think we'd see a whole different reaction to the piracy. And you know, this is one of those things that I hate to say this, but there's sort of I dare use the word racist. There's sort of a racism in the way we treat the issue, because most of the hostages being held by the pirates are not first world citizens.
That's not a. We talked about this years ago. If those were all Americans or Brits being held ashore, there'd be hell to pay. But the Filipino Fifth Fleet and the Bangladeshi battle group isn't quite going to appear tomorrow to take care of that. And again, it's just going to be kind of like the question we had before. What is it going to take? It's either going to take the right leader in the right place at the right time or an unmitigated crisis. And then people will act, because that's human nature. Sometimes we're proactive, but more often than not, we are reactive. And that's kind of the situation we see in piracy. It's just not painful enough that people have the will to do something about it. There's plenty of will to mill about smartly and to, okay, you've got command of Task Force X, and in 3 months this nation will take it and we'll tool around with our flag, but we're really not going to do anything about it. We're just going to react. And I tell you what, I am about shot with all the questions I had. I know you had one more from Saturn V. Why don't we take that one more question and then we'll call it a night, Eagle One.
Okay. Let's see. I get to choose between two. Will the current covert operations and actions, Stuxnet blasts and arsenals, killed, captured nuclear scientists, etc., prevent Iran from making an A-bomb? Or will this turn into an open military confrontation? There you go. How about that one for an easy question?
Going out the door. One, will those things by themselves stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon? No. Will they buy time? Yes. I think if the world is waiting for America to do something about it, yeah, good luck with that. No. We're not going to attack their nuclear facilities. We're not going to invade Iran. It's just not going to happen. If, like they did with Syria, and if, like they did in Iraq a decade plus beforehand, if the world is waiting for the country they like to hate the most to save their butt again, i.e. Israel, I don't think the Israeli Air Force is going to do your dirty work for you either. It's one thing to hit Syria, another thing to hit Iraq. Getting to the middle of the Iranian desert, yeah, there's a logistics issue there for you. And Iran's a different bucket of goo. in those other countries. So if the world is waiting for America and Israel to solve their problem for them, I think they're fools. There's just not the appetite to do what would need to be done to really eliminate that. It's like I said before, it's mid-20th century technology. All they got to do is get enough visible material, and they can make it happen. The Iranians have a great academic tradition. They've got some great scientists, many of them educated here in the West. They have the brain power to make it happen. So it will happen eventually. I think some things have been done that have perhaps moved the timeline to the right some. But I do not expect to wake up any morning hearing that 10 B-2s took out, everything needed to be taken out, or that the Israeli Air Force, using whatever they're going to use, took out the Iranian nuclear threat. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think if we were in the business of preventing countries from developing their atomic weaponry, there are a lot of other countries we would have taken out by now. I mean, if we were in the business of doing that by force, we would have taken out a bunch of other people by now. I think that as one of the people in the chat room is indicating, that we've cast our lot to a large extent with defense, missile defense systems, trying to slow the speed with which the Iranians can develop these things until we can get more systems in place to encapsulate them. And, you know, we have nothing, as far as I know, we have never felt that we had anything against the Iranian people. We have a little problem with their government, and if the government of Iran would magically disappear and be replaced by something more acceptable, then I don't think we'd have any problem with what they're doing now or in the future. But it really is a question of whether, you know, if we're looking at a world of crazy talk, we find a lot of it coming from that area.
Yep, the best way to avoid the Iranians using their nuclear weapons against the U.S. national interest is regime change, and the Iranians are going to have to do that for us. I don't see us doing it. But that, I think that's our, we'll end on that apocalyptic view of things. I want to thank everybody who's in the chat room that held up for us for an hour and 45 minutes, for everybody that either called in with questions or emailed us questions. I appreciate it, but mostly I appreciate everybody's support over the last 2 years. It's really, really been a blast, and I'm looking forward to the next year. We've already got some great guests lined up. And Eagle One, I also wanted to thank you. You're a great co-host.
Well, let me extend that thanks back to you. It's been it hardly seems to me like it's been 2 years, and I want to thank everybody who's listened to us and sent us questions and who's participated as guests. And, this has been a blast. I look forward to doing this for as long as we can take it and as long as people will bother to dial in. So thank you very much to everybody, and I hope you all have a great 2012.
Thanks, buddy, and we'll be seeing you again on the next episode of MidRats. And as always, have yourself a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.